Welcome everyone to the June 4th, 2019 work session of the Springfield Planning Commission. Instead of taking formal attendance, I'll just say everyone is present. We have one work session item today, which is a discussion of the Main Street Safety Project from Molly McCarrion.
Evening. Also here is Brian Barnett, our city traffic engineer, who's on our project team and supporting me tonight. Small note, I just wanted to let you know that I think we explained a long time ago the way that the project management of this project works is that I'm the city project manager and we have an ODOT project manager, and then our lead consultant from DKS has a project manager. And the DKS project manager last month, May, decided to go back to working in the public sector, and so we have a new consultant project manager on the project, and it's working really well as of now, but just want to let you know that that's kind of in the works behind the scenes. I was last here in March, and so I'm going to do just a brief update on where we are in terms of the project timeline and the community engagement efforts that we've done since I last saw you. And then we'll move into reviewing the future baseline conditions memo that you received in your packet. So that memo is focused on what Main Street will look like in 20 years if the city does not take any action with regards to infrastructure changes. I'm also going to share some highlights from another memo that was included in your packet that is the business and property owner impact literature review. Last time I was meeting with you, we talked about the goals and objectives for the project. And so based on the feedback that we got from you, as well as the city council and other stakeholders, we revised those goals and objectives and developed them into an evaluation framework that I'm going to cover and then seek your input on. Just for review, the purpose of the Main Street Safety Project is to select infrastructure solutions that will make Main Street safer for people walking, biking, driving, and taking transit. Again, our project area is on Main Street from approximately 20th to 72nd. And the project timeline, while the dates are a little bit delayed at this point in time, we are right at the beginning of developing of solutions. This spring, city staff presented information about the project to a number of community groups, Chamber of Commerce Government Issues Committee, Twin Rivers Rotary, and we'll be going to the Springfield Rotary Club later this month, and then also Springfield City Club and Springfield Board of Realtors. The Springfield City Club meeting also resulted in some TV coverage about the project, and so even more people became aware. We got a lot of great questions from folks at those meetings, and those questions ended up populating a lot of our FAQ sheet that we just finalized this week and will be starting to share with the broader community. Moving into future no-build conditions, there was a link to this memo in your packet, and I believe actually the full memo is included. For this analysis, our technical team projected traffic volumes into the future to see what would change about intersection operations, multimodal conditions, and safety performance as compared to the existing conditions that we shared with you earlier this year. The purpose of a future baseline is so that we have a point of comparison as we develop solutions and then screen those solutions. We can determine whether those solutions will have a positive or a negative or no impact on what it would be like if we don't do anything. We learned by doing the future baseline analysis that by 2040, we'll see an approximate increase of traffic volume of 20% to 30% on the corridor. And this, according to our technical folks, is pretty general for the growth. It's not in excess or way under what would be predicted. In terms of mobility standards, which is traffic volumes in comparison to the capacity of particular intersections, we do see that there are four intersections that are forecasted to exceed mobility standards by 2040. We noted during our existing conditions analysis that for a number of these intersections, we're already close to capacity, and so as we see more congestion, there will be more delay. In terms of the pedestrian environment, similar to what we saw in the existing condition, we will see a high-stress pedestrian environment. And that takes into consideration that the intersection of Main Street and Mountain Gate will be signalized, and a mid-block crossing will be added at Main Street near 38th. Those are already planned for, so it takes that into consideration. And similarly with the cycling environment, in the future we will see a high stress environment, and that analysis is also noting the Virginia Daisy Bikeway from 32nd to Bobstrom.
Main Street and Mountain Gate, meaning 67th-ish?
Yes.
Okay,
about it.
These were the figures that we showed for the existing conditions, and so, which is as a point of comparison as we look to the future. But for the existing conditions, in the data set that we used from 2012 to 2016, we noted 653 crashes on the corridor and spread throughout the corridor. Looking into the future analysis, I'm going to look to Brian to maybe explain this a little bit better, but as it's been explained to me, two inputs into the model are traffic volume and site characteristics. And then there is the model. And then the two outputs are predicted crashes and expected crashes. And actual crash data also is considered for the expected crash rate. And while that's more accurate, it can't be used for future conditions. And so in order to have an apples-to-apples comparison, of existing and future no build, and then the future alternatives, we have to go with the predicted solution. But there's probably more
home run.
Nuance to it. The primary finding of the future no build analysis is that the increase in traffic volume just further degrades safety along the corridor. Based on the analysis, we will likely see approximately 19 more crashes per year. And it's coincidental, but that amounts to just over a 19% increase over the existing condition. Access density is a major contributing factor to crashes on Main Street. Main Street has an average density of 75 access points per mile, and we know that the standard baseline for many agencies, including ODOT, is 10 access points per mile.
Okay.
And crash risks increase by 4% for every access point above 10 per mile. So we have significantly higher density on this corridor and contributes to, in some segments along the corridor, nearly 500% increased crash risk compared to a facility that would meet the 10 access points per mile standard. So if the access points density remains the same, the combination of that density and increased traffic volume will continue to degrade safety on the corridor. So that is something that we'll be looking at in the solutions, is adjusted. Before I go into the literature review, do you have any questions on that?
Yeah, the access points per mile, it varied a whole bunch across the corridor too, didn't it? That there were like some areas that were really way over and then some areas that were smaller. Is that not correct? So where are the really bad areas for access points per mile?
Well, it's probably a lot simpler to answer the question of how many good places there are. And that would be in the vicinity of 54th to Bob Straub Parkway or Highway 126, that signal, and then also out 58 from that point. That segment between Bob Straub and 58th has really already been access managed from a median perspective, and I think there was a driveway closure or two that ODOT and we undertook actually in two separate phases about 15 to 20 years ago. There was a high crash occurrence in that location, or that, you know, that segment, and so there was a motivation to do that at that time. And so that didn't ameliorate those concerns.
We have some economists on our project team at Echo Northwest, based in the Seattle office. And they reviewed available literature to help us understand the impact of street changes, such as roundabouts and medians, on businesses and property owners. Again, there was a memo on that included in your packet. So just in terms of context from the economist point of view, their gold standard for literature includes having experimental and control cases, before and after studies, and data collection that reflects revealed behavior, so after the fact. But those are difficult and expensive to conduct, and so there are very few studies that attempt to measure the effect of road rate changes on retail sales and business performance. But of the studies that they were able to track down and examine, they found that impacts to businesses are likely not significant and may be positive overall. Of course, there are a lot of caveats to that I'll get into. Before they dove into the literature review, they did gather information about businesses on the corridor. They made a request from the Employment Department for data from the quarterly census of employment and wages, and they created two buffers around Main Street, 500 feet and within a quarter of a mile. So within a quarter of a mile, customers are typically accessing businesses by turning on and off of Main Street, and then within 500 feet, the business's front door, they would access that front door. What this diagram is showing us is that within a quarter mile of Main Street, there are 418 businesses employing nearly 4,000 people, which is 14% of the citywide total. It's also 10% of the citywide total payroll. I And then within 500 feet, we are seeing that there are 282 businesses employing about 2,500 people, which is 9% of the citywide total, and the total payroll 6% of the city total. This figure is referenced in the memo as well, and is showing the factors that influence businesses from a street redesign. So the various elements, roundabouts, medians, turn restrictions, transit priority, and pedestrian signals. And that will have an influence both on corridor performance, so the ability of people to access the businesses, and then and move through the corridor, and then actual access to the businesses. And so that affects site accessibility for businesses, which then, you know, has an impact on access by employees, and then access by customers, also deliveries. And so then how that affects operating costs and sales, and also ultimately in the long term influences property values. In particular, Echo Northwest looked at the impact of raised medians and roundabouts on businesses and property owners, and from the studies that they reviewed, they learned that these solutions, raised medians and roundabouts, result in businesses performing as well or better than their counterparts in corridors where they aren't implemented, and that relates to their sales performance. That said, even in examples where sales data demonstrates that business performance has improved, businesses still perceive medians as a potential impediment to customer and delivery access.
So you're saying that's more of an impression, though, not necessarily one that's borne out statistically.
Correct. In looking at a number of the before and after studies, and then the surveys of perceptions, we see that there's no clear indication that access management, safety projects, and corridor investments to improve the operations of corridors leads to declines in businesses. The studies did show that there is some evidence that businesses in mid-block locations may be more susceptible to lower customer visitation as a result of access restrictions. And also businesses that more heavily rely on pass-by traffic as compared to a destination business may be affected by access restrictions. And then also, the literature suggests that losses during construction may be the primary negative effect. And we also know that construction impacts would occur from any corridor reconstruction, regardless of the configuration of that. Echo Northwest wanted to also look at the impact to property owners, looking at property value. And what we saw in looking at the literature is that if site access is improved, profits may go up, the property owner may increase lease rates, property may become more enticing to other businesses, but then the reverse is the same. If access is degraded, then property values may go down. So there's no real key finding from that information. Any questions on that statement?
I thought the literature stuff was kind of interesting, that it was kind of counterintuitive what some of the folks thought, a lot of people thought that their business was going to go down, and that wasn't necessarily borne out. Another interesting thing I thought was that there was at least a mention of some better response time for emergency management in some of the literature. That were a couple of my takeaways.
So was this entire section prepared by a consultant group?
Yes.
Okay. One of the things, I opened up a couple of the sources, and one of the sources that struck me was on attachment 2, page 16 and 40, New York City Department of Transportation 2013, measuring the street, new metrics for 21st century streets. That was used as some of the basis of evidence for some of the arguments in here, and I don't know if city staff actually looked at that source, but it was really lacking. It didn't really have any background information. I think there were assumptions made about where they were gaining information unless they were contacted, like the Department of Transportation New York City was contacted on top of that, because it was really just like a flyer. Or a brochure. And one of the other things is that the logic behind some of the writing for the property values washing out the difference with gross sales changes, I didn't see any sources for that. I mostly seemed like conjecture, and it said general economic consensus, but it didn't make any sense to me having an economic background, so I don't know where they were coming from. So.
I appreciate that. We provided a lot of feedback to the consultants about their sources and also being more specific than general economic theory and things like that. So we can dig into these particular things.
Thank you.
In the same vein, speaking of economics, I noticed under the freight discussion that finished goods were probably, they say they're way less tonnage, but way more value along the corridor. And I was wondering, with the way the economy's changing, that we may be going toward more finished goods and away from sand and gravel and logs, that would we have a corresponding increase in trips by freight that would make, even though the tonnage would be going down, it'd be making more trips? I think that's a pretty logical inference. And did they look at economic forecasts in developing some of those concepts?
I do recall Courtney Griesel, our economic development director, bringing up the question about sectors and finished goods.
I recall that as well. It's, economics is not my strength area, and so I hesitate to answer definitively. What I can say about the transportation mix is it's highly dynamic, and what will be an economic trend this week, month, year, or 5 years will not necessarily be that. It's going to be a 5 or so years out, 20-year planning horizon. So. I'd be loath to give you any more than that.
So there is, another follow-up question then. Is there a kind of a breakdown between what is freight traffic and business traffic and what is personal commuting or pleasure trips or whatever by private parties?
In the context of the economic analysis, I'm not sure how they did that. I presume it was based on... this is a presumption that it is based on heavy truck traffic, i.e. semis. It's not talking about what volume is UPS delivering that day.
Okay. Thank you.
Are you taking wrap-up questions, or do you have another segment yet?
Pardon me?
Do you have another segment yet, or is this wrap-up questions?
Yeah, I have another segment.
Oh, okay.
Memo 10 that was in your packet covers the goals and objectives, and we reviewed draft goals and objectives with you last time, as I mentioned earlier. received feedback from a number of stakeholders, refined that, and produced the final goals and objectives. The development of those goals and objectives was informed by the values that we discussed with you and others earlier in the project process, that was in turn informed by prior planning efforts on the corridor. And we now have evolved all of that into the evaluation framework, which consists of the two tables that you have before you. The first table that I'd like to focus on is the solutions evaluation criteria. In this table, at the far left column are the goals, and then the middle column lists the objectives, and you've seen the goals and objectives before. And for each objective, if you recall, starts with the introduction of identify infrastructure solutions that, which is at the top of this column, and then each objective. And then in the far right are the solutions evaluation criteria. And they will be used to help us compare and understand trade-offs between the various solutions. I think it's important to note that some objectives are supported by multiple criteria and others not so, and that doesn't imply that one objective will be more heavily weighted. It really means that that objective can be evaluated by more quantitative analysis as compared to qualitative analysis. And so when we present the solutions to you, the full package of solutions, we will also be presenting a summary of the evaluation criteria, and so you will be able to see how well any particular solution meets the various objectives as compared to the future no build. Any questions on that table before I move on to the other?
So the solutions will be developed in the future.
They're being we started today, so they're being developed this summer. Related to the next table is a discussion of the Senate Bill 408 process that we touched on during the community engagement plan adoption and review and adoption. So I just want to do a brief refresher on that. Access management is the practice of managing location and design of vehicle connections to a street to improve safety and travel efficiency with the aim of reducing the number of conflict points. So as we talked about earlier tonight, the high driveway density is one conflict. And so in 2013, Senate Bill 408 changed Oregon law regarding the management of access onto state highways. And the reg that's been implemented into OARs, Oregon Administrative Rules. And it essentially stipulates procedures to increase the level of involvement of stakeholders, property owners, and local government in decisions that will affect property access onto a state highway. And we noted when we talked about the community engagement plan that these requirements don't really diverge significantly from what we are used to in the land use realm as comprehensive community engagement. But there are a few nuances, and so as it will relate, or as it will pertain to Main Street and the Main Street Facility Plan, because it is possible that access management will be a component of any one or more solution, the facility plan process has to follow the Senate Bill 408 requirements. There will be no specific access recommendations that come out of the facility plan. That will happen in the future when the plan is implemented, when solutions are designed or constructed. But what will be in the plan is direction and decision-making criteria that will be used at the time access management may be considered. And so, and that's the key principles and methodology. So if you look at the second table, it's proposed key principles and access management methodology. And I'm going to talk a little bit about each column. The key principles, per the regulations, need to support the overall facility plan goals and objectives. And in considering the community interest that we are required to consider and balance those interests through the Senate Bill 408 regulations, we determined that it seems most appropriate to have the goals that were developed for the evaluation criteria also serve as the key principles. And then the way the methodology column works is similar to the way the evaluation criteria measure how well a solution supports the objectives. The methodology provides criteria to assess whether decisions about property access onto the highway are consistent with the key principles. So these would only be used in the future when solutions are implemented, but will provide all stakeholders with an understanding of how that will be determined. Any questions on that? What we're looking for from you, and I know that you just gave these to you tonight, and so you can always email me later this week if you have additional thoughts. Is there anything missing? Does this make sense? Do you see the feedback you gave us on the goals and objectives reflected in what we've presented here?
Your top one on safety, define the width of undefined approaches. Can you just kind of remove that means?
I would think it would be not a defined driveway. I don't know.
I believe what that's driving at is that there are a number of businesses that have almost unrestricted driveway access across their the entire area of their frontage.
Okay. Not a driveway. Not. I mean, it's just. I'll drive out anywhere.
You're driving off the shoulder into the lot.
Okay. Thank you.
On the methodology one, the I don't see highlighting the cycling stuff under transportation sort choices or vital community. I might not just be getting the translation between the methodology one and the other goals, but...
No, I think that's a good catch because I recall in other earlier versions, bicycle and pedestrian connectivity was like a slash, and we said there should be two separate ones, and so I'm thinking maybe
okay.
The other one is not put in.
Thank you. I feel like I felt like the goals and objectives and evaluation part addresses what I heard our conversation be pretty well.
As I recall, on our March 2019 work session on this, there was a discussion of environmental changes, and I don't see that environmental-related changes. And I don't really see that in the goals and objectives.
So, I believe...
Maybe I do see it.
I didn't
flip the page.
Yeah, it's in vital community.
Thanks.
Yeah, no problem. No question.
Go ahead.
So I noticed that on methodology, vital community didn't have any listed methodology, but there was an explanation. I was just wondering, could you clarify on maybe why there's no methodology for doing the things that are goals, objectives, and solution evaluation criteria?
I think in a nutshell, we couldn't come up with any metrics, anything that could be measured, or criteria that would be related to an access change associated with that goal. Mm-hmm. So if you have thoughts or ideas, we would love to hear them, but they have to be something that can be measured, either qualitatively or quantitatively.
So specifically for access management, that's sort of the issue of why it does apply. Okay, that makes more sense. I wasn't thinking of it. Thank you.
I'm looking at the proposed solutions evaluation criteria, transportation choices. So the objective will be to support existing transit service and provide flexibility to accommodate enhanced transit service in the future. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to be evaluating it by looking at the compatibility with existing and potential future transit service.
Yeah.
Will you be evaluating what changes would need to be made to accommodate like a bus rapid transit line? Usually they require like dedicated bus lanes and limited access points. So, like, is that what you're looking at when you say enhanced? Or
I can't remember if we sent it to the planning commission or not. But where the main McVay Transit study has evolved is to a place now where. The project team for that project is recommending to the Main Street governance team that enhanced corridor be the preferred transit mode for Main Street. And enhanced corridor is not really specifically defined, but it is not MX, it's not bus rapid transit, it is more focused on operational improvements along the corridor, possibly stop enhancements, possibly queue jumps at signalized intersections. I can't think of what some of the other...
Refuges, maybe for turnouts for at stops.
Could be turnouts, possibly. Could be level loading. Could be a number of the elements that are associated with bus rapid transit systems, but not all of them, so it doesn't qualify as a bus rapid transit system.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, I don't recall how it was written there. but when we say enhanced transit, that should be capital E, capital T. It is a title, not a concept.
Yeah.
And LTD has a definition around enhanced transit, which is a subset, maybe it's a subset, that might be a little too strong, but it's, it is the building blocks that get to a bus rapid transit, but not all of them, and they're not anticipating in their planning horizon that they would go to bus rapid transit. So they've taken the bus rapid transit component off the table and are focusing on enhanced transit at this point.
Okay, thank you. And then just one more on that. I know the 11 is along that route, and that is like that is really high ridership. Do you have like onboarding and offboarding data along the corridor to see like which transit stops maybe aren't being as well utilized, and if there's design standards around that that cause that or might correlate?
Well, I know LTD has that information. I don't know if it was in our existing conditions memorandum, but that tech memo certainly could cover that. If it does not, we might be able to make an amendment to that. The main McVeigh Transit study would have had that kind of information in it, and it progressed to a point, and then this process got started, so it's kind of, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it's kind of enveloping the transit study into the facility plan. There are two independent steps that Lane Transit has to make because of their funding and rules that are distinct from the ones we're operating under. But we're getting them. The two projects have merged. Our council has been very clear. They want one process to handle both situations. LTD, though, will have some independent steps to take in the future.
One of the components of the enhanced corridor is stop consolidation. And so I do know that as the safety project advances, LTD will be looking at what's being proposed for safety improvements and then determining where possible stops could be consolidated along the corridor.
And if you're interested in those locations, a cue that we can use is where the locations that we built the rapid flashing beacon crossings for the islands. Those, one of the criteria in that pedestrian safety study was where the most heavily used crossing points, which is driven in large measure by the most heavily used transit stops.
Since LTD has a definition of enhanced corridors or enhanced transit, are there, do you know of any existing examples within Lane Transit District of an enhanced corridor?
I am not. Are you, Molly?
I'd just be curious to, you know, see if there was one.
No, and the challenge is that the concept is kind of a universal concept in the region, but will be applied differently in each corridor.
Right.
So, for instance, how it's applied on Main Street will be different than how it may be applied on River Road or Highway 99. I do know that that term is being used for the moving ahead process in Eugene, looking at the future corridor improvements, but how it applies on the ground could be slightly or quite different than Main Street, because enhanced corridors, this broad spectrum of improvements, could be closer to existing service or closer to MX and anywhere on that.
So different packages of the same elements.
Yeah.
Okay.
The LTD has a rather fluid definition of enhanced service.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you for your comments.
We are working on the solution, alternative solutions, this summer, and then we'll be coming back to you in the fall or November. Those and what we've heard from about what can we do then.
You can go up to a wrap-up point now?
Yep.
Okay. Because after I went through the material, I had a list of different questions or comments, and I whittled it down a little bit, so it won't take too long. But first of all, on wait times, I noticed in the material, and also you touched on it as well, reference to extended wait times on afternoon peak driving times eastbound, there was nothing stated about the presumption that the reverse is true in morning peak driving times going westbound. Is that a presumption?
The dynamics of vehicle flow in a city such as ours is that there is a morning peak hour traffic, and it would be, as you would presume, westbound. But the peak in the morning and the peak in the afternoon are very different. The afternoon peak definitely has a higher peak. And so we don't see the same degree of congestion occurring because of traffic growth generally being visible to us in the morning as it will be in the afternoon. So it's a time issue, not a directional issue.
Oh, all right. Thank you. And also, in the four problem intersections, or at least future problem intersections that were mentioned, 28th, 42nd, 58th, and the Parkway, the one that I'm most familiar with is 28th. And I'm thinking, because there is significant problems in the afternoons on 28th, that perhaps nothing more than tweaking the signal timing would solve a lot of the problem, because I've noticed that north-south traffic usually clears through one light cycle, and east-west on Main Street, it oftentimes takes three light cycles for traffic to clear. And part of the problem with that is that westbound, the traffic oftentimes backs up past the access point on North 30th to all the apartments. And so that intersection becomes completely stalled until such time as the traffic level diminishes. And I know that if the city had funding, it would be nice if that traffic could be routed across the north of the Forestry Center over to 32nd, where there is a signalized intersection and basically nothing other than Les Schwab north of the intersection. So I think that would resolve a lot of the problems, and I realize that may not be a solution looking 20 years down the road, but it would probably be a help under current conditions, particularly that intersection. I don't know if there's that same problem at the other intersections that I'm not familiar with, but that seems to be something that would be helpful on 28th anyway.
So there's two... There are two components to your question or your statement, and I'll take the latter first. We did work with Les Schwab and with the Department of Forestry on getting a forestry access to that location, and based on the Department of Forestry's budget, they elected not to invest in making that connection so that they could access the signal as much as we might like. The first part of your statement about it takes three signal cycles to clear Main Street when it will clear the North and South streets in one signal cycle, and that's driven primarily from the fact that we have to give a minimum green time for North and South that is equal to the time it will take a pedestrian to clear the intersection. So with a 5-lane plus bike lane crossing distance from curb to curb, that's a fair distance, and so that green time is associated with that crossing. So, you know, the reverse is true, is that when you're on Main Street using the pedestrian crossings, those crossings are much shorter, so the amount of time we can give is less in proportion. But the bottom line is we actually give more green time to Main Street, but we can't give less to the side street. If we were to choose to give more green time to Main Street than we currently do, which is more than the side streets get, we would end up growing that total time that takes to move through each of the movements, the cycle length, and that grows the queues that much longer. And so it's you're chasing your tail at that point.
So there isn't really an alternative other than accommodating the pedestrian crossings?
Well, at one time that signal operated with north and south running concurrently, but the left turn on 28th to Main eastbound is so large that a single left turn lane wouldn't work.
Right.
And so that's why we split those two movements up, and that is less efficient for Main Street as a result.
All right, thank you. And one other item that I'll touch on is on the area of raised medians. the last time we discussed this project, I indicated that I was leaning toward opposing the concept of raised medians. And since then, through experiences, I think I'm more strongly opposed than previously, because the issue is, with a rail crossing in the 3000 block, there just happens to be an island directly east of that crossing. So as a result, when you're heading westbound and waiting for up to 15 minutes for the crossing to clear, knowing the cooperation level of the Union Pacific Railroad, people are blocked in that want to do a U-turn to get away and take an alternate route, because they, unless they've got a high-rise pickup and drive right over the island, you simply are stuck in place until the crossing clears. So, not to say that that is going to impact other raised median areas, but it does have an impact on that particular section of the Main Street.
Another thing on South 28th is we just expanded the UGB down there for industrial properties. So there's probably going to be more traffic coming from South 28th. So it looks toward maybe a longer term solution for that intersection than a smaller tweak, which might help temporarily. Any further questions or comments? Okay. I guess we'll go ahead and adjourn and reconvene at 7 p.m. for our regular session. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
You had two charts, right?
Yes.